Psalm 45, beginning of verse 1. My heart overflows with a pleasing theme. I address my verses to the king. My tongue is like the pen of a ready scribe. You are the most handsome of the sons of men. Grace is poured upon your lips. Therefore, God has blessed you forever. Gird your sword on your thigh, O mighty one, in your splendor and majesty. In your majesty, ride out victoriously for the cause of truth and meekness and righteousness. Let your right hand teach you awesome deeds. Your arrows are sharp in the heart of king's enemies. The peoples fall under you. Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of your kingdom is a scepter of uprightness. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness beyond your companions. Your robes are all fragrant with myrrh and aloes and cassia. From ivory palaces, stringed instruments make you glad. Daughters of kings are among your ladies of honor. At your right hand stands the queen in gold of Ophir. Hear, O daughter, and consider and incline your ear. Forget your people and your father's house, and the king will desire your beauty. Since he is your Lord, bow to him. The people of Tyre will seek your favor with gifts. The riches of the people. All glorious is the princess in her chamber with robes interwoven with gold. In many colored robes she is led to the king. With her virgin companions following behind her, with joy and gladness they are led along. As they enter the palace of the king, in place of your fathers shall be your sons. You will make them princes in all the earth. I will cause your name to be remembered in all generations. Therefore, nations will praise you forever and ever. Now, there's a movie that's over 50 years old, a movie from 1970. And if you were alive and at that time you remember it, it was a famous movie dealing with love. It's called Love Story, starring two very attractive young actors and actresses, Ryan O'Neal and Ally McGraw. And it was an interesting story. It was a story of a rich young man who, at college, he meets this young woman, and they are immediately attracted, and they fall in love. It's a tragic story. She dies at the end. But in the story, the basic plot is he meets her, they get together, and he's from a rich family. And he brings her home, and his parents don't like her and say to him, if you marry her, we will disinherit you. Well, he does. And they go on to college, and she works, and he finishes Harvard. And through it, they try to do a family, and they find out that she's terminally ill. And he asks his father for money. And he says, what, did you you know, did you do this? Did you get her in trouble or something? And he said, he just said yes to tell him the real reason. And so he gets the money. She goes to the hospital. There are a lot of things in the movie. And at the end of the movie, he comes out after she dies. And his father's there because he found out the real reason. And the one thing he says to his son is, I'm sorry. And Oliver, who's his son, says, when you love, there's no reason for sorry. I'm not sure the exact line, but that's the idea. Well, it's interesting because it has a very famous song written by Harry Mancini, which ultimately was recorded by a couple of people, but it's a famous song. It's called Where Do I Begin? In the first stanza of that movie, the song goes like this. Where do I begin to tell the story of how great a love can be? The sweet love story that is older than the sea. The simple truth about the love she brings to me. Where do I start? Again, that's helps us to understand because we're now at a psalm which is different from most all the psalms that we've experienced as we've gone through the Psalter. We've seen a lot of themes in the psalms, but one of the common themes is this theme of lament. And as we looked at these psalms, the psalm of lament, we're trying to show you that it's the lament of Christ as he comes to suffer in this world, purchase the church in obedience to his father. And we saw also how the laments that we have in a sense connect because we are united to him and we share in his sufferings. But you see, the suffering is not the end of the story. It's interesting with the movie Love Story at the end. It's a depressing story. It really is. They had a sequel, of course, you always have to have a sequel, called Oliver's Story, and he meets somebody else, Candace Bergen. But what this song does is it brings us to the end of that story. It brings us to that love, that motivation that the Son of God had for his bride. And it brings us to the end of that. This is we call this a wedding or a marriage song. It's a song of happiness. It's also called a wedding song. And in order to understand this, we can contrast and see certain things with movies like Love Story, which is, according to Hollywood, the ninth, number nine in the list of the greatest love movies. But here we come to the greatest love story. The greatest love story that was ever told. Love story that not only is timeless, but is enacted in time. And when we understand this, we need to understand a little bit of the genre of weddings of the ancient world. You see, the way weddings were happening in the ancient world is that usually you had a couple and there was an arrangement between the families, and they were betrothed to one another. There was a betrothal. And it was when then they could actually say that they were husband and wife, though they had not consummated the marriage. And there would be betrothed, but usually there was a dowry connected. And there was a time between the betrothal and the consummation of the marriage, sometimes a long time between. And the wife or the betrothed woman and the betrothed man would live in separate houses, still in their parents' house. And after a certain amount of time, they would then have a wedding itself, the wedding itself. It could be a long time. And we get, see, when we talk about, remember Joseph and Mary? A little bit of that time. Remember, he had betrothed to her, and then she was found with a child, and it wasn't him, of course. It couldn't have been him. And then what would happen, though, is that the husband, the betrothed man, would go and go to the wives' house call her. And then there would be a celebration, a movement from her house to his house. And the wedding party would go. And then they would go into the chamber and the wedding would be complete. Well, that basic procedure is what we find in the psalm. That's what the psalm talks about, is that procedure. You see, in verses 2 through 9, we see the king coming for his bride. He describes the king who's coming for the bride. In verses 10 through 12, we find some advice given to the bride as she waits for her bridegroom. And then in verses 13 through 15, we see the bride being led out to the king in procession, making way to his home as they enter. So let's look at this ultimate love story, not one written or not one in a movie from 1970, but now with the one that was written with the blood of Christ for his church, which is what this speaks of. Let's look at really the beginning of this in verse 1. Notice the psalmist now is speaking. It's interesting because as we read a lot of psalms, the psalmist either speaks to God or he speaks to himself. Here he's speaking to a king. My heart overflows with a pleasing theme. I address my verses to the king. My tongue is like the pen of a ready scribe. You see, he addresses. He addresses the king. It is interesting because as we look at this psalm, we notice something too, and I will make this mention. If you look at verse 12 and 13, look at verses 10 and 12. It implies something. It intimates something that, again, this is a royal wedding. It says in verses 10, "Hear, O daughter, consider and incline your ear, forget your people and your father's house." Notice that, again, when a wife leaves, just as a husband says, "You leave your father's house and you cling." Right? That's what wife does as well. We know that. But notice, and that's there, but notice it's your people. And so many exegetes think that this is a royal wedding of a woman from a foreign nation. Again, often that's what royal weddings were. We think of Solomon, we think of other kings. They would leave their foreign, and they would cling to their new, the king of Israel, who also would also mean cling to God. And foreign people did that. That's how they, and that's probably what's going on here. This is a royal wedding, probably a king of Israel. This wedding song may have been done a number of times. People say, exactly, was this one for Solomon? Was it for Ahab? It was probably used on many of the kings. This was probably, and that's why it's put in the Psalter. This reflects the procedure or the song that was done probably in many royal weddings. Notice it's a song from Korah, a love song. That's the ascription, at least that's given to us in our scriptures. But notice that it's a song that's addressed to the king and the person or people. They say that they are like a pen, like they're a ready scribe. And it's a pleasing theme. He tells us the theme of the psalm, unlike love story, which ultimately ends in, I consider, depression here. It's not death, but it's life and marriage eternal. Well, now let's look, with that introduction, let's look at verses 2 through 9, which is could be titled The Praise of the King. See, here we're speaking about the betrothed king. And look how it mentions him in verse 2. You are the most handsome of the sons of men. Most handsome. It's interesting because there is one other who is called handsome within Scripture, using the same Hebrew word, and you know who it is. It's David. 1 Samuel 16, verse 12, we read, and he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy and beautiful, and had beautiful eyes, and was handsome. And the Lord said, arise, anoint him, for this is he. You see, the outward appearance of the handsomeness of David was not like maybe that of his son. You see, the beauty or the handsomeness or the beauty of this king that's reflected in the psalm, which I think we find as David is prototypical, is a handsome that also reflects the internal. See, it's not just external, but it is also internal. Actually, the other place where we find mention of someone being handsome is another love song. The love song in the Bible, the Song of Solomon. In chapter 1, verse 16, we read, behold, you are beautiful, my beloved, truly delightful, our couch is green. So he's handsome externally, but he's also handsome internally. And we see that in the next line. It says of him, grace is poured upon your lips, therefore God has blessed you forever. Grace is poured upon your lips. You see, that's speaking of the words that come out of this king. This is not a harsh king who will harass. He speaks true words of goodness. The inside's important. The words of this king is important and will be important for the marriage. I think that's reflected by Paul as he speaks about the marriage and the husband when he speaks in Ephesians chapter 5, verses 25 through 26. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her that he might sanctify her, cleansing her by the washing of water and the word. You see, the words of the king are grace and sanctifying. So we see how he's described both internal and external, and then we're told that he not only is in himself, but he's the one who also wins the victory. See, he's the victorious king. And as we look at the victory, which are beginning being described in verse 4, we need to understand first, begin at verse 3 of the victory. But we want to first look at verse 4, because what verse 4 gives you is what he's fighting for. It's implied, it's given in the psalm. Look what it says here in verse 4. The second line, for the cause of truth and meekness and righteousness. See, it right, that's the cause, because of. Now, every translation translates that differently. But it basically means, King James says, because of truth and meekness and righteousness. You see, what he's saying is he's running out for the purpose of truth and righteousness. This is the king who's going to marry this woman, as she's described. He is one who's going to be victorious. Listen to what it says in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 23. And who is like your people Israel, the one nation on earth whom God went to redeem to be his people, making himself a name and doing for them great and awesome things by driving out before your people, by driving out before your people whom you redeemed for yourself from Egypt, a nation and its God. Notice it mentions that God made himself a name by driving them out through great and awesome deeds. That's exactly what we have in verse 4. You see that? In your majesty, ride out victoriously for the cause of truth and meekness and righteousness. Let your right hand and your awesome deeds teach your awesome deeds. You see, Israel's king was to be the victor and was to for God's people, and he's just emulating God. He represents God. And of course, we love the fulfillment of that, don't we? Goes on to say in verse 5, your arrows are sharp in the heart of the king's enemies, and peoples fall under. You see that describing? Again, that's what happened when God redeemed his people to himself and brought them to himself and brought them in the land, and that's what Christ does. And then we have verse 6. Look at verse 6. As I read Hebrews chapter 1, verses 8 and 9, look at your scripture. Listen to what the author of Hebrews says. But of the Son, he says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of rightness and the scepter is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with oil of gladness beyond your companions. You see, the author of Hebrews is quoting Psalm 45 and ascribing it to Jesus. See, Jesus is the king it's speaking about here. He's the one who comes and reaps victory for the purpose of truth, meekness, and righteousness. He is the one who has these awesome deeds of deliverance for his bride, his beautiful bride, whom, because of his, as we say, his grace poured upon his lips, he's going to speak to her in such a way. Verses 8 and 9, we see here now is prepared for the wedding. Notice, therefore, God has anointed you with oil of gladness beyond your companions. When did that happen to Jesus? Well, after his work. I mean, there's a sense in which he did the work of suffering, but his name and being raised and resurrected and ascended, that was all in preparation for the wedding. You see, he was betrothed to the wife, but he had to do the dowry. He had to give to the wife. So now he has robes that are fragrant with myrrh and aloes and cassia. Not the burial clothes, but the clothes that come after him as the resurrection. See, he's preparing. He's being prepared for the wedding, for the consummation. And it speaks about all those who honor him. You see, when he was here in his earthly life, before his death and resurrection, he was not honored. He was not even considered handsome, was he? He had a form in which we did not consider him, but now he's gorgeous and glory because he's won the victory. But now, in verses 10 through 12, it begins to address the bride. And there's a calling of the bride here. See that? Hear, O daughter, and consider and incline your ears. I'm going to tell you something. You who are going to be betrothed, you who are going to be ultimately in that cosmic marriage with this king, I have some words for you. I have some advice for you. And the first advice is, we can summarize, forget the past. See that? Forget the past. That was a problem with many of the wives of Solomon and those kings. See, their wives came, and they didn't forget the past. They brought their past. They brought their idols. And those idols entrapped their failures of husbands. The epitome of that is who? Jezebel. But Jezebel, when she came. By the way, who's the contrary to Jezebel? Who's the anti-Jezebel in Hebrew history? Ruth. She didn't come to Israel in marriage, but she was married. Her husband died. But she did not, she forgot her people. She left and yoked herself to Naomi. Your people are my people. Your gods are my household of old. You know, you had Orpah. You know, she went back. But Ruth stayed. And that is the advice that's given in the psalm. Your God will be my God. Forget your father's house. By the way, we don't do that in our marriages, do we? What's the term? When you marry somebody, you marry their family. Right? Well, here, the encouragement is forget the past, forget your family, which sounds harsh to us. But of course, if we understand it, and if this is about Christ marrying the church and those who are in the church, then you need to forget your past. You need to forget your kingdom of darkness. And you need to come into the house of Christ, his Father's house, a place where he's going to make a place for you. There is an utter separation. See, this is what Abraham did as a person in faith. And this is what he was called to do in faith. Genesis 12:1. Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. This is the principles that being taught. This is the advice. Forget your past. Jesus says something very similar, and it's very harsh when we read it, but if you understand it in its context, it makes a lot more sense. In Luke 14, verse 26, he says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And this is a principle that's taught early on in Scripture, right? Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. See, a really good preacher, a Baptist preacher, Walter Chantry, in commenting on this, says the following. It is painful to leave behind mother and father, son and daughter. We are all attached to the beauties and friendships of this world. Forget them all. The King will more than make up for all. Someday you will look back upon the parting with temporal things and think your hesitation was silly and ill-founded. When you sit in the ivory palace, arrayed with the gold of Ophir, at the right hand of the eternal King, you will wonder what you saw in those former things. You will never regret it. Carry through with your discerning choice. The King must be your one and only love henceforth. See, forget the past. That's not the only advice. The other advice is, seen in verse 11. Look at verse 11. The King will desire your beauty. That's the King. And then it says, since he is your Lord and bow to him. See, this wife who's going to marry the king, she's the object of his desire. By the way, in the fulfillment, now, it could be that the queens and that Solomon married, they were just so beautiful, he was just blinded by their beauty. But in the fulfillment, which is Christ in the church, we can actually, this is where that statement is really true, that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. See, there is nothing in us, in ourselves, in the church, by itself, outside of Christ's work, that is beautiful. But he gives us beauty. One of the best hymns ever written is in Can It Be? Everyone knows that. In one of the lines, it reads this: "Thine eye diffused a quickening ray. I woke the dungeon flame with light. My chains fell off, my heart was free. I rose, went forth, and followed thee." Now, see, what's being described there is that Christ, by the power of his look, by the power of his eyes, made the dungeon flame with light. Now, when you think about the hymn, we're not sure what Wesley meant by it, but there is a sense in which we figured it was that light that caused the chains to fall off. But it was also the light that changed the heart of the one in the dungeon. See, my heart was free. You see, it is as you look and as you receive the word, as you're washed by Christ's word, you become beautiful and desirable. Why does he love me? Why does he love the church? Because he loves the church. And he makes her what he loves. He makes her holy and pleasing. Think about by the washing of the water and the word. See, so when we read it in beginning, the king will desire your beauty. He desires, you are beautiful to him, and then he desires to make you beautiful. I think both fit that. In the context, of course, the king just sees a beautiful woman. But in the fulfillment, brothers and sisters, you are all beautiful. And you're going to be more beautiful. And then he says this: since he is your Lord, follow him. You see, here he's talking about submission. You see, there's submission. You see, he is your Lord. Follow him. By the way, as he works in you, you're going to desire to do that. But this is the advice: you follow him. And that submission is fruitful. Verse 12. You see, when the wife leaves your father's house and goes to this, remember, most of the verses describe the king and what he did. Only a few verses describe the betrothed woman. He is what is really desired. You know, a lot of times women don't get married because they look at all the men that are polymarital and they got maybe some good thing, but there's a lot of negative about it. It's not true about this king. But it's truthful. Look what it says. The people of Tyre will seek your favor with gifts. Tyre is a place of commerce up north. It's pagan. It's talking about the pagans. They're going to desire you. They're going to give you gifts. Think about when Israel left, when God brought Israel to himself, right? The Egyptians gave them gifts because of what God had presented them with. By the way, in the later prophets, the Exodus through the Promised Land, the prophets say God betrothed Israel to himself. Well, then we come. The riches of the people, that's what's described there. And then in verses 13 through 15, we find that wedding procession. Look how it's described. all glorious as a princess in her chamber. It describes her, because now she's ready for the wedding, with robes interwoven with gold. In many colored robes, she is led to the king, with her virgin companions following behind. Here's the procession going into the king in the chamber. With joy and gladness, they are led along, and they enter the palace of the king. Notice what's going on there, by the way. Unlike what we have often in this world, it's like the old movies. They get to the chamber, they go in, and no one sees what happens. You see, this is the bride whom he's going to lavish with love and care. No, it's not a direct thing. It reminds us, and the principle here, I think, is seen when Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 2, verse 9, the following. But as it is written, no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor heart of man imagined what God has prepared for those who love him. You see, the bride goes into the chamber, and we're not told, because it cannot be described. See, our language and what's going on is describing these true eternal things. And then we have the conclusion, verses 16 and 17. One thing you need to see here is, it's hard to see in English, because remember, in verses 10 and following, it's addressing the woman who's betrothed. And then we read in verse 16, in the place of fathers, of your fathers, see that you're there? Would almost imply speaking about the woman, and she can have children instead of her father. When you read it in English, it sounds like that, doesn't it? But in the Hebrew, because it's gendered language, people wouldn't like that today, but it's gendered language, the pronouns here, the your, both the yours in verse, and the you in verse 16, are all masculine. So, people say, speaking here now addressing the king. But it probably means something more theologically important than we're switching from the queen to the king. It probably is best to take this as the one flesh principle now. See, she's no longer herself. See, this now is not addressing the queen or the betrothed woman. It's not addressing the betrothed man, it's addressing the couple, the one flesh. And now as a couple, they're going to have children. See, that's what's being described here. And it fits with the woman. You'll leave your father's house. Now you're going to have your own family. It's going to be a different family because it's identified with the king. That's why it's a first person masculine. That's why Jesus said, this is my body. See, now the woman, the church, which is the fulfillment, becomes Christ. And now it has that name above all names. It will make them princes in all the earth. I will cause your name to be remembered in all generations. We think of the Abrahamic promise and the name being great. Therefore, nations will praise you forever and ever. That song, Where Do I Begin, talked about what it said is a story of how great love can be. That story is not how great love can be. The story that tells how great love can be is a story of Christ's love for his people. Turn with me now to the book of Revelation. As you're turning there, really Revelation 19. I'm going to read a couple of other verses. You see, there is a sense in which was the application to as well. If you're a Christian, then the church is what's left us. That's what happened. You've done that. But remember how we said the ancient, the practice of being betrothed and then consummated? See, the church has been betrothed to Christ. You are now in that betrothal stage. The question is, are you like the 10 virgins, which maybe this has in a thing? Are you waiting for the return of the bridegroom? See, that's really what we need to be taking here. Are we imagining the bridegroom? Do you have hope? Is that where your hope is set? First John 3:3, and everyone who thus hopes in him purifies himself as he is pure. You see, he's purified by the word, but we make means of this, and we're involved in that. John 14, verses 2 and 3, and Jesus says, in my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would not have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and take you to myself. For where I am, you will be also. And then in the book of Revelation, we're in 19, but I'm going to read chapter 1, verse 7. It says, behold, he is coming with the clouds, and every eye will see him, even those who pierced him. And all the tribes of the earth will wail on account of him. You see, the return of Christ is mentioned to us in Revelation 19. And it's an interesting section. Look at beginning at verse 6 of Revelation 19. It's the marriage supper of the Lamb. See, that's the consummation. It says this. Then I heard what seemed to be a voice of a great multitude, like the roar of many waters, and like the sound of the mighty peals of thunder, crying out, hallelujah! For the Lord our God, the Almighty, reigns. Let us rejoice and exalt and give him glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his bride has made herself ready. It was granted her to clothe herself with fine linen, bright and pure, for the linen is the righteous deeds of the saints. And the angel said to me, write this, blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said to me, these are the true words. They fell down and worshiped him. But he said to me, you must not do that. I am a fellow servant with you and your brothers who hold the testimony of Jesus. Worship God, for the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy. So it describes this. He described what's going on. And then look at verse 11. Verse 11, the bridegroom is revealed. And look how he's described. Then I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse, and the one sitting on it is called Faithful and True. And in righteousness, he judges and makes war. You see, he comes for his bride and goes after her enemies. That's what's being described here as well in our psalm. But now, look at Revelation 21. There's a lot of description between 20 and 20, but look at Revelation 21, verse 9. We read this. Then came one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls and the seven last plagues and spoke to me, come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great high mountain and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, having the glory of God, its radiance like the most rare jewel, like jasper, clear as crystal. The city of God, the church, is the bride. You are the bride that he desires. Brothers and sisters, what's great about this psalm is in a psalter that's full of lament, it tells us that history has a purpose. Your life has a purpose. In 2020, it's hard for us to understand if there's a purpose to anything, isn't it? But there is an end. And that's where your hope is. This is a great song. This is a song that encourages you that Christ will restore all things. And he did it because, but he loves you. You see, Christ is your Lord. love. This is true love. This is the love story. This is the love story that we need to tell ourselves, and that we need to tell those others to come, become part of that process.